Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, when the New York Times wants to write about the plights and travails of low-wage workers, they can tug a heartstring with the best of them. When it comes to reporting about the economy, serious, fact-based stuff, not human interest, we get things like the piece the paper ran in late July, with the lead on how analysts expect the strong economy and Trump administration's tax cuts to lead to another batch of knockout earnings reports. One blot on the landscape, wage growth. Quote, rising labor costs can cut into profits, muting the impact of a robust economy, close quote. The paper warns, citing a trucking firm where driver pay and retention costs were described as outlays that nibbled away at the benefits of higher prices and booming volumes. Like the health of the economy being somehow severed from the livelihood of most people, there are certain economic ideas and values that corporate media either leave unchallenged or aggressively promote. We're going to explore some of those on this week's Counterspin. First up, the idea that some people just don't deserve to earn a wage, that entire sectors of the workforce can be reliant on the variable noblesse oblige of customers. We talked about the bizarre retention of the tipped wage with author and activist Saru Jayaraman a couple of years ago. We'll hear part of that conversation again today. The same media that largely ignore the sub-minimum wage rarely question the overall belief in social mobility, and in particular, the idea that if you only get a good job, U.S. society is pretty much set up to guarantee your economic success. We disrupted that vision with researcher Diedrich Asante Muhammad last year, talking about a new report on the racial wealth divide. And finally, the big myth that the way the U.S. economy is organized is the best or maybe the only way a democratic society can do things. That harms like inequality may shadow it, but they don't define it. Economist Richard Wolff took that on in a conversation earlier this year. We'll hear some of that again on today's show. Media's economic myths and misinformation today on Counterspin. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. She's author of the books Behind the Kitchen Door and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. When we spoke with her in 2015, we asked what she thought people should know about the tipped wage for restaurant workers.
I think the big thing people should know is that it is the second largest and fastest growing sector of our economy that pays the absolute lowest paying wages in the country. And that is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which leads the Fortune 500 chains, restaurant chains in our country, and whose power dates back over 100 years to the emancipation of the slaves, when they essentially first fought for the right to not pay workers anything, especially former slaves who were the first tipped workers in our country, not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And there's just such a great deal of misinformation about who those workers are today, even. You know, there's such a misperception that the Restaurant Association likes to promote that these are very well-paid tipped workers, white guys working in fancy fine dining restaurants, when in fact, the vast majority of tipped workers in America, 70% in fact, are women who work at IHOP and Applebee's and Olive Garden and earn a median wage of $9 an hour, including tips, and suffer from three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States because they are forced to live in large part on tips rather than receiving a wage from their employer.
Well, some of the defenses of tipping that are being brought out now really reflect that kind of feudal attitude. Richard Cohen at the Washington Post writes, quote, I like to reward, but occasionally I like to punish, close quote. I mean, And it really gets at something, I think, at a kind of the baseline and telling you, hearing you say the origins of it really are, it really does come from that kind of attitude that people should serve at your pleasure.
That's right. And let me be clear, because, you know, what I really appreciate about your show and program is, you know, really clearing up what maybe other media sources have conflated. You know, our fight, our campaign is not actually at this minute to eliminate tipping altogether. That's a huge misconception. We are trying to eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers, which this industry has gotten away with for over 100 years. The true history is that tipping originated in Europe. When it came to the United States in the late 1850s, there was a massive anti-tipping movement so great that five states passed bans on tipping. And two industries, the restaurant industry and the Pullman Train Company, squashed that movement and demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And that idea that the restaurant industry in particular could not pay its workers a wage and let them live on customer tips was codified into the very first minimum wage law as part of the New Deal, which gave tipped workers the right to a $0 minimum wage. And we've gone from $0 in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in our country. Now, there are seven states that have completely eliminated that system and demand that the restaurant industry actually pay its workers a full wage and let tips be on top of that. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska all demand that the restaurant industry pay a full wage and let tips be on top. And so our campaign, our effort has been to eliminate that lower wage for tipped workers, that two-tiered system that's essentially legalized gender pay inequity because it's mostly women living on the lower wage. Our fight is to eliminate that lower wage for tipped workers everywhere across the country, not at this minute to eliminate tipping. There are restaurants that have chosen to follow our lead and eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers in their restaurants by eliminating tipping. And if they're doing it in a transparent way that makes their workers whole, then we are fully in support of that. But right now we feel that, you know, as long as we're talking about minimum wages in this country of $10 and $12 and $15 an hour, that's actually not enough to live on anywhere in this country. And so tips are absolutely necessary at this moment on top of a wage to get workers closer to something livable. But what we don't want is what we have right now, which is that those tips can be counted against wages so that, in essence, most workers in this industry, in this country, are living almost entirely on customer power, on that sort of power to punish and or reward, rather than on a base wage from their employer like every other industry has to provide.
Well, let me ask you as a point of information, because when outlets like the New York Times and USA Today print articles about the tipped wage, as a matter of course, they get a letter from a representative of the National Restaurant Association right. that says no one gets a sub-minimum wage, because if wait staff don't get enough from tips plus that $2.13 an hour to get up to minimum wage, the employer tops it off. Now, is that the law but not the case?
That's exactly not the case. And so the U.S. Department of Labor reports an 80% violation rate with regard to this issue of employers having to make up the difference hour by hour and ensure that tips actually bring you to the full minimum wage. I mean, it's, you know, I feel for employers. It's an extraordinary burden to have to ensure hour by hour. It takes, you know, a lot of accounting and HR, which most small businesses don't have. It's a tremendous burden on small business. And I will say, actually, this is partly why so many employers have started to move in our direction, why we're seeing so much industry shift on this issue, is because even some employer-side attorneys have come out saying this is tremendous liability and burden on small businesses in particular that have to calculate this difference or get sued. So it doesn't happen. It's a huge liability. But really fundamentally on top of that, I want to say even if there was 100% compliance, which this issue, which there obviously isn't, it still wouldn't work. Because when you're a woman who lives off of tips for the majority of your income, as 6 million women in America do, you have to tolerate whatever a customer might do to you, however they may touch you or treat you or talk to you, because the customer is always right, because the customer is paying all of your income, truly, because your wage is so low. If you get $2 or $3 or $4 an hour, as it is in 43 states, your wage is so low, it goes entirely to taxes and you're living completely off your tips. So if you're living completely off your tips, you're completely dependent on the whims of the customer and you have to tolerate this kind of behavior. And our research shows it goes a step further. We found that management in states with lower wages for tipped workers encourages women to objectify themselves, wear tighter clothing, show greater cleavage in order to get more money and tips at three times the rate as they do in states like California, where a woman actually gets a full wage and doesn't have to rely on the whims of a customer. I mean, you know, that absurd comment by the Washington Post reporter, in any other industry, any other service profession that we interact with daily, from retail to getting gas to anything that we do where we interact with customer service, if we're not pleased with service, we have the right to go to management and complain. And that is how it should be in this industry, too. We have the right to go to management and complain. But a woman's ability to pay her bills and not have to sell her body and feed her family should not be dependent on the whims of customers. It should be dependent on her employer who supposedly employs her and has the responsibility to ensure that she's actually paid for the work that she does.
Last September, elite media were heralding numbers suggesting that incomes were up among middle-class Americans, but tiptoeing around the fact that the rising tide was not lifting all boats. Diedrich Asante Muhammad is Senior Fellow, Racial Wealth Divide, at the group Prosperity Now. He told Counterspin about a report he co-authored called The Road to Zero Wealth: How the Racial Wealth Divide is Hollowing Out America's Middle Class, from Prosperity Now and the Institute for Policy Studies. I asked why they chose to focus on racial disparities in wealth.
I think wealth as a foundational economic indicator is very important. Wealth tells a stronger story about where people are situated socioeconomically. Wealth is what allows people to ride out or deal with challenging economic times, which we all go through. Wealth is what allows you to take advantage of opportunities that might put you in a better socioeconomic position in the future, whether it's starting a business, money to buy a home, money to go to higher education with less debt. And so we see that wealth is a much stronger indicator of the socioeconomic status, and we think this is what needs to be looked at more often to help us understand how the economy is doing. And let me point out, related to the article you had previously mentioned about, you know, middle income being at the highest it's been and that we've kind of recovered from the Great Recession. I think it's great. You know, we need strong incomes. We need strong employment figures. And racial minorities, Blacks and Latinos in particular, still have great divides in income and employment. But I also want to note that for the country as a whole, Black, white, or Latino, no one has recovered in terms of wealth from where they were before the Great Recession. And I think too often people get it wrong, that people just feel like the recovery hasn't touched them, but it deeply has. But when you look at wealth, no one has gotten near to the wealth they had before the Great Recession, regardless of race. So there is a strong reason for all Americans to feel more economically insecure than they did before the Great Recession.
So the numbers and the information in this report, there are a number of different ways that you come at it, you know, in terms of data. But what can you tell us about the size of this gap in wealth, according to race?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's also helpful to understand the difference in income and wealth. Like, African-American Latinos make about 60 cents on every dollar, or about that, depending on how you measure it, that whites make. But in terms of wealth, the disparity is much greater. The median wealth for whites in 2013, where we have the most recent data, is about $117,000. That's the median wealth for whites. The median wealth for blacks is $1,700. The median wealth for Latinos is $2,000. So you see this huge gap of around $2,000 to $117,000. That shows a disparity that's even much greater than the strong disparity in income or in employment as well.
Well, before I ask what drives the wealth gap, what doesn't drive it that people might think does?
That's an interesting question. There's been some reports coming out recently from some Yale authors about how it's interesting that higher income whites are those who seem to be most off in understanding the economic difference between blacks and whites historically. And the Yale authors point to this idea that when people are economically successful, they like to believe that a system is working. And so then they must assume that when people aren't doing well, there's something that they aren't doing right. And they will underestimate inequality. And I think in general, in terms of economic differences and with wealth differences, there's some belief that, well, if African-Americans or Latinos, whatever group you want to focus on, would just use their money better, that they would be in a much better economic situation versus that maybe something structurally has been driving the inequality that existed throughout the history of the United States. And I think we can point to what has structurally helped create the wealth divide and what is a challenge to the American middle class as a whole.
Yeah, you often hear about, well, if communities would value education, you know, that educational attainment is really the difference between lacking wealth and having wealth.
And that's one thing we highlight in the report as well, as we highlight that even if you look at educational attainment, you see there's massive wealth disparities. We see that whites with a high school diploma have more wealth, almost twice the wealth, of blacks and Latinos with a college degree. So education in itself does not at all bridge the racial wealth divide. And two, if you look back, again, median wealth for blacks is $1,700, median wealth for Latinos is $2,000. That's a very small amount. A minor car accident will wipe that away. That might cover your salary for a week or two, depending on what you're paid. So there's not much room for any type of error or crisis or setback, and not much money to take advantage of opportunity. That won't pay for a semester of college almost anywhere. So we see when you have that little, there's a very little you can do to actually advance your economic fortunes when you're stuck at a 1,700, 2,000 median wealth that seems to be on the decline.
Well, you sort of hinted toward it, but here's where we do need to know some history, because when you hear about the creation of the middle class in this country, you know, it wasn't just history's inevitable march. You know, when we're talking about structural drivers, you know, there was policy behind that, right?
No, absolutely. The middle class wasn't something. One, many people might assume that the country has always historically been a, you know, large middle class economy, and that's not true. And it wasn't just market forces that created a strong middle class, and it wasn't just market forces that created, in particular, a strong white middle class. The majority of whites did not become homeowners until the 40s and 50s. You know, after the New Deal following the Great Depression helped create a strong social safety net to help all Americans, and white Americans in particular, to get back on their feet after the Great Depression and provided things like Social Security and other things to help people, and actually even like work opportunities to help people stabilize themselves economically. And then this was followed up with a very strong economy post-World War II, with a lot of the benefits of becoming a victor in a global war, and with this policy like the GI Bill that did massive investments in social infrastructure, in massive subsidies to higher education, home ownership, that, as we know, in the 40s or 50s, we had outright legal segregation, outright legal discrimination that prohibited African Americans and other people of color to benefit from this mass investment that helped create the middle class, that made whites the majority homeowners for the first time, that made the American economy a strong middle class economy for the first time. Blacks, Latinos, Native Americans were not able to get that type of investment. And my analysis is, without that investment, blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans and other people of color never will be able to catch up to the historic strong white middle class that we like to think back upon.
When we spoke with him earlier this year, I noted that news media don't even present economics as a contested realm. It's as if there's only the system as we currently have it. So it's very difficult to think about making changes in that system.
No, you know, it's always struck me as bizarre. Even if you are a great lover of capitalism, our system, and you just think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, even if you're like that, if that's your point of view, The fact is that places like, I don't know, let's pick one, the People's Republic of China, for the last 25 years, that economy, which is organized in ways that are different from the one we have here in the United States, that People's Republic of China has achieved the most rapid economic transformation from poor country to superpower economically that we have ever seen in the history of the human race. Okay, that alone would mean we ought to be exploring in our classrooms, in our media, what's that about? How did they accomplish that? How, that's something that most of the world's people dream of, and so it's an important matter. And now you add a couple of other considerations, that it's the largest country by population on this planet, and it is a superpower, has nuclear weapons and all of that, and you'd say any rational person would understand, of course we have to look at that model of how you do economics, how you organize an economic system, to ask the logical, rational question, not necessarily, you know, we must copy them, but are there things about what they do and how they organize that we might be able to learn something from? I like to point out to my students sometimes that the world's largest debtor country is the United States, and that the largest creditor country of the United States is the People's Republic of China. If nothing else, that should provide a hint, and I'm trying to be polite here, a hint that we ought to explore. And your question is exactly right, because in 99% of the curricula of the United States in economics, there is nothing of the sort. There is no program, no course, certainly no sequence of courses, which is what you would need to do a proper exploration over a year or two or three. There's nothing of the sort. So that when I go and I try to explain to people how that economy is different, you know, I'm starting from scratch. They haven't the faintest idea of what I'm talking about. And worse than that they don't know is that they have no sense in their heads that there's anything there they ought to have been taught, they ought to have learned as just being a citizen and making rational decisions. So, I mean, another way to put it, we have an economic system in which the enterprises of this country are pretty much organized in the same way. At the top of each enterprise is an owner. The owner can be an individual, can be a family, can be a partnership, but most of the business in America is done by an owner that's called a corporation. It has shareholders. The shareholders elect a board of directors, usually 15, 20 people, and they operate the enterprise. There can be a few hundred employees, there can be a few hundred thousand employees, and everything in between. Now, that's a very interesting way of organizing business. Not the way feudal manors were organized. It's not the way slave plantations were organized. It's peculiar to capitalism. But here's a simple fact which ought to illustrate, in a sense, the question you've asked. This is an extremely undemocratic arrangement. What do I mean? Well, the number of people that make all the key decisions in American corporations, and by that I mean deciding what to produce, deciding how, what technology to use, deciding the physical geographic location, will it be produced in Cincinnati or in Shanghai, etc., and finally, what to do with the profits that the labor of all the people working there have helped to produce. All of those key decisions that shape the lives of everybody involved in a company, and indeed everybody in the larger community, are made by tiny groups of individuals. The major shareholders, that 1% who own three-quarters of the shares, or two-thirds of them, and the boards of directors that they choose, this is a tiny minority sitting at the top of every corporation, looking and acting pretty much like kings and queens once acted when there were monarchies instead of democratic parliamentarian systems. And we don't question that, we here in America, with our commitment to democracy. We seem not to be able to ask the obvious question. If we like democracy, as we say we do, if we insist on some sort of accountability of the political leaders who make decisions that impact us, why in the world do we not make the same demand, democratic accountability, of the economic leaders in our society, the people who run these enormous corporations that are the dominant economic factor in our society? And we don't. And the funny thing is that, of course, there is an alternative. Just like there was an alternative to monarchy, namely political democracy, there's an alternative to the hierarchical, top-down capitalist corporation. And it has a number of names because it's very old. The one that's being used much these days is worker cooperative or producer cooperative. And the basic idea is we would have a different economy if we organized our enterprises in an alternative way, namely instead of hierarchical or vertical with a tiny unaccountable leadership at the top. We didn't do that. We said there is no leadership, or to put it differently, if there isn't a leadership, it has to be elected by the workers in an enterprise. They have to have the right to recall these people. In other words, that the workers in a place have democratic rights in the workplace that are roughly analogous to the politically democratic rights we have in the communities where we live. If you did that, all the decisions that we have lived with and that have produced the economic problems with which this conversation began would be different.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.